Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and I'm excited to bring Rusty back on the show for today. How are you?
Doing well. How are you doing, Doug?
I'm doing awesome. And today we're going to be talking about optimizing the last year of work or so, roughly about a year or so. And hopefully this will be helpful with some good tips for folks that are still working out there. And I'll give a disclaimer early on here to seek professional help, because we're not professionals. It's not legal or financial or any kind of advice. We hope it's entertaining at best.
Entertaining, maybe educational, but yeah. But we're not going to tell anyone to do anything specific in their own lives, for sure.
We're just telling stories here. Yeah. And Rusty, it's good to have you back on. You had the idea for this show, and I'm curious why this was on your list.
This is one, well, I try to pick things that I have something somewhat intelligent to say about, so it's a pretty small pool to choose from, but I do feel like this is one thing that my wife and I did particularly well, and I think because we did some of the things that we did, it helped us kind of milk out at least $100,000, maybe even a couple $100,000 of value from that last year of work. So I would like to share some of the things that we did, and hopefully gives people something to think about when, if they're also approaching that last year or year and a half of work, and add some value to their lives.
We have a few different items, and all credit to Rusty here. You created the outline. This is one of the, I don't know, it's like an evil genius thing that I've put together where like I can invite people that have good ideas. The more I stay out of the way, the better that it could be. So the outline that we have here, we're going to go over timing this, the pros and cons of quitting versus getting fired or laid off, setting up debt facilities, which I think you have a lot of like boots on the ground kind of information that people are very interested in, healthcare, setting up withdrawal strategies, optimizing 401k, donating to charity, and fully funding 529. So a lot of like strategic, extremely strategic, and thinking pretty far ahead. So this is exciting, and let's jump into it. So timing, and a lot of people end up in the one more year and then another year and then a few more months syndrome over and over again. And there can be some benefits.
Yeah, I think there's a really important distinction between truly working one more year and having the one more year syndrome. And as you said, the one more year syndrome is saying one more year for year after year. And I think people are worried that they're going to get on that slippery slope if they just even say one more year one time, that they're never going to retire. It'll be 10 years later. They'll be at like a 2% safe withdrawal rate. They'll have totally overshot the mark. But going from your 4% mark to working truly one more year, I think has a lot of benefits. First of all, just even with average market returns, if you go from that, start your one more year at the time you hit your 4% or 25X number, if you work one more year beyond that, that gets you down to 3.6%. So a lot of people in the FIRE community debate 4% versus 3.7 versus 3.3. I think Big Earn is even like, if you're 100% equities, you should be more at 3%. So a lot of kind of debate out there about what the true safe withdrawal rate is. I would contend that all of them are safe in any portfolio mix. That's my, not to step on a live wire there, but that's, or touch on a live wire. That's how I feel. But if you do truly work one more year, that takes you from 4% to 3.6%, which gets you a whole nother level of safety. And by working that one more year too, you're also then generating more income, and you've presumably been saving at a high rate. So that will take the 3.6 down even lower, even potentially low, probably pretty easily to get it as low as 3.5% just by working one more year. So to the extent you're the type of person that has a lot of consternation about, is 4% the right number? Is 3.6% the right number? Just truly working one more year takes care of that and really eliminates that sequence of returns risk. One benefit that we found, so that was essentially the situation we were in. We were at our 4% number, and then we were like, let's work a little bit longer. We had really good market returns that last year too. So put us more honestly by the, and then we were earning a high income. So by the end of that year, we were probably more at like a 3% rate by working by doing that. And we found from doing that is that we don't worry about portfolio design at all. We're 100% equities. And we're like, to the extent we were exposed to risk at all, that's been taken care of by just oversaving for one extra year. And so my wife and I never change our portfolio mix. We never even really talk about it. And even when it comes up on like some of the podcasts we listen to, sometimes I'm like, I'm just going to fast forward through this part. Like I don't even give that any thought anymore. So that's been a benefit of being a little bit of an over earner, over saver, is that we don't have to worry as much about the investment mix.
Interesting.
And I like the quote that is, save like a pessimist, invest like an optimist. And so that I feel like pretty much embodies the approach that we had. Yeah.
So a couple clarifying questions here. So yeah. Number one, 100% equities aside from real estate.
Is that that's right? True. Yeah. We have real estate. Okay. Yeah. But real estate's like 30% of our portfolio. Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
And that's just our primary home, our primary and secondary home. Yeah.
Not investment properties. Yeah. Yeah. And okay. So that's interesting because I mean, the other set of people, like I just got back from economy and a lot of people just like the self-masturbatory, that's redundant, I guess, the masturbatory thoughts of thinking about safe withdrawal rates, which is exciting. But when it comes down to it, yeah, it's like people will disagree on even the semantics of the question that they're at, like it just goes on and on. Fun conversations sometimes. All that to say, do you operate with like a safe withdrawal rate, or do you operate from the expenses which you have and then you cover that?
Yeah, and they don't come close to what we should probably be withdrawing if we were doing a true safe withdrawal rate. But okay. We're living the life that we want to live. We don't feel like we're ever not doing something because of money. So but we're not, I don't think we're close to 4%. So
and it's like that rule of thumb, 4% is a good target as you're accumulating, but as a prescriptive amount of how much to spend, then you would be like, oh, we have to spend X amount, which might be like 2 or 3X what you actually need. And then you're trying to figure out how to spend money just to spend it.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And I don't want to be stressed about trying to spend more money. So
it's a fun problem.
We're in a nice spot. And that's been one of the benefits of over saving a little. I mean, I guess I know there's a push to try to spend more, but we oversaved, and I'm not gonna, I really feel like we're living just like this dream life. So I try not to stress too much about trying to figure out ways to spend more money. Yeah.
Do you know your withdrawal rate roughly over the average? Or, I mean, you don't need to calculate it, so there's no value in you.
I mean, at first it was like, at first we were struggling to even spend like 2% of our rate. Having the houses has helped bump up the withdrawal rate. So I think we're closer to 3 now, but we might even be under that. And I don't calculate anymore. The only thing I do now is really pay attention to our net worth, and it just goes up so much every year since we've been retired. So I know that we're not even close to the true 4% withdrawal rate. So,
yeah, okay.
So
yeah, we're not either. And we also don't look at it from like, oh, here's what we can withdraw. Although I try to lean on that to help us like fill our bucket so that we have, Elizabeth is big on budgeting. So just to make sure we're like, oh, we are making decisions based on what we want to do, not from a scarcity mindset.
Yeah.
Okay. So all that's very good. Final question around this, which you could punt it because it may come into play around the debt facilities, but 100% equities for your portfolio portion. In the event that the stock market went down by, say, 40 or 50%, does that put you in a position where you would need to sell at a lower price? Because I was chatting, I think this may come out on another show in a few weeks, I was chatting with Pete, Mr. Money Mustache, and he's very far along in his retirement journey. He's probably oversaved as well. and he mentioned just having 100% equities and no big deal. The market should go up, you know, be an optimist about it. However, I'm like, it depends on your risk tolerance and where you are in the journey. So if someone has slightly undersaved, maybe they only have whatever, a much smaller portion of compared to what Pete or you might have, right? If they have to sell at a 50% down market, they're kind of fucked. They may have to get a job again and like it really screws things up. Recession might last 3 or 4 years. It may not, but no one knows. We just know a new recession is coming along the way before too long, right? So in your position, you're like,
my position, no. And I do think, I do attribute at least part of that to the truly working one more year. So that person who was extremely lean, I would say if they had done things a little bit differently and maybe got to the 4% number and worked one more year beyond that, that buys you a lot of buffer because that starts compounding. And then if you're, you know, if you've had the last 5.5 years go like they went for, if your first 5.5 years of retirement go like my first 5.5 years have gone the past 5.5 years where the stock market doubles, then you're really in a great spot. Yeah. Even if you were super lean. So, and the other way that we think about risk too, is it's not just all based on our portfolio. Cause I mean, that would mean you're 100% committed to the idea that you're never going to earn any more money. And my wife and I were high earners. I think either one of us could go get a 6-figure job by the end of the week if we wanted to. And I mean, we could probably be making more like $300,000 a year if we put a couple months into job searching. And then there's just other ways. We just see other ways to make money too that are more entrepreneurial all around us. So If we were really in one of those tough positions, if there was a 50% market drop, where we're at right now, 50% market drop isn't material because our net worth almost doubled the first 5 years of retirement because of market returns. So a 50% drop just puts us back to where we were at the start of retirement. So, but yeah, but if we really, the way we would handle that risk is we would find ways to make money at that point. And I do think the people who are really lean, I think they are more exposed to market risk, but they're also, they could go find, they're typically living off of around 40 grand a year. And it's not hard to find a way to make 40 grand a year. So I don't feel like they're actually as exposed. That their worst case scenario is everyone's base scenario, which is they go find a job. So it's not really a worst case scenario. It's like, well, there's an upside where they might not ever have to go find a job. And there's a downside, which is they go live the life that everyone has to live. So it's not really the lowest floor.
And by the way, I basically agree with you.
Okay.
But I'm asking questions for other people maybe have a more conservative, but I want to
clear
the air.
How dare you? No, just kidding.
It is interesting because sometimes people will hear advice from folks that are not giving advice to someone in their position. It's like a different, you have to understand from where that advice is coming from and if they're considering the other side. But you can get a job making a little bit of money and it'll bridge the gap. And if you're a little flexible, which I think all of us probably are, I mean, no one says 4%, never fucking look at it, and then just continue to spend the exact same amount for 30 years. Like, not going to happen.
Right.
Your assumptions are going to be wrong anyway. All right. So back to
I would say one more thing about timing. Your comment about not everyone's situation just reminded me of this, but one component of it is maternity, paternity leave, which doesn't come into play for everyone. But if you are considering retiring in your 30s or, you know, early 40s, it's something to keep in mind. And I've definitely had friends at the law firms. A lot of the law firms were doing 1 year maternity leave and they would do like 12 weeks of paternity leave. And especially people who were planning to stay at home with the kids after that, they would coincide their leaving work with making sure they got that full leave. So, you know, for a mom to take the full year of maternity leave, get paid a significant amount over that course of time, and then to not go back is another factor. Doesn't apply to everyone's scenario, but if you are considering early retirement, it can coincide with the age that people are having kids. And so that's one factor I've seen people Georgie's really getting getting up on you.
For the listeners, Georgie decided to stay downstairs. She must have heard you arrive, and she was like, oh, Rusty's going to record in a second. So she's under my table here, aggressively poking me with her snout, so I keep petting her. So I have to pat her and keep the show moving in the right direction, which next question here is tips for people if they have one more year syndrome to just put a line in the sand and move on.
I would, so you're the one who posed this to me. And so I would say there's kind of two different approaches, the way that I see it. And one would be you hit your 4% number, you go into your office the next day, act like you won the lottery, and you're like, I'm out of here, bitches. we're gone. And I guess the way that I did it was just to be like, hey, we hit our 4% number. I'm going to start burning this bridge, but slowly. So put like a little bit of gasoline on the bridge, start a small fire, start fanning the flame and kind of getting it to spread out a little bit and kind of have it have the burn bridge slowly over the course of a year. That would kind of be my sort of alternative take. So, and the reason you would start burning the bridge is because that prevents you from getting into the like true one more year syndrome where it's like, oh, I'm still being an awesome employee. They're going to keep me around forever. I'll just end up working 10 years past when I should have quit work. So the burning the bridge, or at least adopting more of that FU mentality is, I think, a good way of kind of maybe committing to it without the full on commitment of just announcing you're leaving the minute that you hit your FI number.
Do you have some good examples?
I mean, my that was my example. Oh, my example
specifically,
of things fanning. That I did. I mean, yeah. So I, by the very end, like the last 6 months, I did maybe 10 hours of work total at the law firm.
Not per week, just total.
Total, yeah. So I was truly not working at all. They one of the things the law firms do is they put it on you to kind of go find work when you're slow. And then they kind of like, they kind of chastise you if you don't have enough hours at the end. But I just took full advantage of that. I was like, oh, you guys are so bad at management, so I'll just quietly not take on any work and not be concerned about it. And gotcha. It takes them, especially at a big organization, it takes them a long time to just even get around to firing people. It's not the most fun thing for anyone to do. So it's like a few months, they let a few months go by and then they're like, what's going on? Like, why haven't you done any work? And then it takes them another few months to actually start like getting rid of you. So I just use that to my advantage.
That's, I mean, the root of that is probably why we're friends, because I did similar stuff. How did you reconcile that with the strong work ethic that you must have to have been in a position that you were in and just be like, you know what? You guys are doing a bad job. Go fuck yourselves. I'm going to chill in my office and what, you're listening to podcasts or reading blogs or something?
Well, a lot of times I wasn't even coming in. So I was just like working out. I was in really good shape at the end of that. Cause it's probably like 8 months. Yeah. Like 8 months total that where I was really tapered down. So I was working out a lot. I would come in maybe around like 10:30 or so. And then I would go out, I'd go get like a really good lunch in Chicago and then downtown Chicago. And I had like this list of 40 restaurants. I was like, I want to try these 40 restaurants in downtown before I stop working. And so I'd go to one of those, have like an hour lunch, and then I'd like peace out around 1:30 or so. So, and then I would do like some of my projects for the day. It'd be like, I would bring my personal papers in that I needed to like scan to, so I'd have electronic records of them. And so I'd be like at the copier, like scanning stuff for an hour. And they'd be like, oh, Rusty must be, that's, just you know, you're, stuff. Yeah, you're out in the middle of all the offices. And so people see you and they're like, oh, Rusty must be doing something. Like he's at the scanner all the time, but it's like, no, I'm just scanning in my tax returns from the past 5 years and things like that. Great. So
someone told me, probably, and then I started doing it and telling, but just like walk around fast with a notebook. People are like, oh, he's going to a meeting, must be really busy, overworked. That's great.
I had one of my friends, and her strategy was always go to the group meetings and always ask a question, like pay attention, ask a question, and then it feels like you're really dialed in. But then she did ask a question one time, and it was about a group that had just left our firm, and her question implied that she wasn't aware of the fact that they had left the firm. So it revealed her. But she used that strategy for like 3 good years, and she
works.
Everyone thought she was super engaged when she was quietly quitting.
I think there's a lot of people in the comments and in the audience. They often get a little offended, especially the people that like to work on these conversations, but I think it's fun. It's like Office Space. Yeah. I mean, you described Office Space pretty much. Exactly. Going fishing, yeah, cleaning your fish on the desk.
And I would just encourage people. I mean, I never had an employer that even treated me somewhat reasonably well. All of them challenged me anytime I wanted to take a vacation and things like that. So I read a good book called Work Won't Love You Back by Sarah Jaffe. It goes industry through industry and talks about how people are systematically mistreated by their employers. So it's one thing to like your work, and I did like my core work, but I also didn't like being treated like a turd most of the time. So I felt like my work, I'd shown up, I'd given a lot of goodwill. I mean, I was just like super overachiever, kind of way you'd have to be to get the job at the law firms that I was working at. And I never had an employer meet me halfway. I never even had an employer meet me 10% of the way. I was always meeting them, you know, 90% of the way. And they're always like, you want a good work assignment? Go out and find one. And it's like, I'm like the lowest level employee here. I kind of need you guys to do somewhat management, and I need to be able to go on a vacation and not have you guys freak out that like, mm-hmm. and act like the sky is falling. So,
yeah.
So I think I, at least in my career, I felt like the scales were always tipped way in favor of the law firm. And even at the law firm, it's like, oh, they pay you a lot of money. It's like, well, I earn a lot of money because I bill at a high rate and I have to bill a lot of hours, and they keep 50% of what I bill. So I didn't feel like they had a bad economic transaction either. So,
yeah. Very interesting. We could go on and on. I'll mention one last thing similar to in the consulting world, like similar to like finding your own work. If you were not on a project, you are encouraged to like go work on proposals and like go into the, like just kind of try to find your own work. And I usually just stayed home also, like for months at a time. It was great. I had just moved into my house and went to a new company. I didn't have a project for like 6 months or something. Like I literally stayed at home and went to the gym, and I was like, oh, let me know when you find something. I'm not going to put together. I mean, I worked on a couple proposals, and essentially you're just working. I'm a bad employee. No one will hire me anymore. Thank goodness. But basically I'm just like, yeah, you're just doing, I'm changing the color on these PowerPoints. And then it goes nowhere and nothing happens. Total waste of time.
Well, and it's just, I don't know, when you're that junior, you're not going to go bring in work to a big, I mean, you were at big four consulting firm. I was like at a, like top 10 law firm. Like the people who were bringing in work were like, oh, I went to law school with this guy who is now the general counsel for McDonald's. And it's like, I don't have any friends who are general counsel for a Fortune 100 company. Like
my friends work at McDonald's.
Yeah. I eat at McDonald's. Like that's the closest I get, but yeah.
Okay. Well, this leads in wonderfully to the pros and cons of quitting versus getting fired or laid off. And I got laid off luckily because I probably wouldn't have had, it wasn't bad enough for me to like quit. So I was fortunate in that I got laid off.
And I got laid off too. That was my end game was to get them to fire me because there are benefits to that. And that's what I think we're kind of going to talk about here. So at the outset, there's a big benefit to quitting, and that is that you maintain goodwill with your employer. And I think there's something to that, but I think people greatly overestimate it because me personally, I would never work for any of the people that I was working with at my last job. And in fact, if I was interested in a job and it just happened to be that one of those people was going to be my manager, I would not be interested in that job at all. So I actually didn't put much value on maintaining that goodwill because I was like, I have a lot of other people that in my life who, you know, would serve as a job reference. You know, I worked for a federal judge who like loved me. And that's about as good of a reference as you can have in the legal world. So it doesn't really matter what some mid-level partner at the last law firm I worked at thought about my work. So I wasn't going to use those people as a reference for anything. If I was ever applying for a job again in the future and they were in some way involved, I would just run away as far away from that as I could. So I was like, I put basically $0 value on maintaining that. But then the benefits of being fired and or like forcing them to fire you the way I did was that you get severance. You're eligible for unemployment. I guess as an attorney, I can say like that's not, you're not guaranteed that unemployment eligibility because if they can prove that they fired you for cause and poor performance can be cause, then you're basically not guaranteed. But a lot of times it's not even an employer's interest to really contest whether or not you're eligible for that unemployment. Then you can also potentially stay on your employer healthcare post-retirement, which is what my wife and I did, which I guess we'll talk more about in the healthcare section. And then you're able to do what I called my victory lap, which was just do way less work the last year or two of employment. So I feel like I cashed in all that goodwill and I probably got, gosh, probably at least a couple hundred thousand, maybe even close to $300,000 worth of value from cashing in all that goodwill between the months of getting my paycheck without doing any actual work, getting my severance at the end. And then I didn't take the unemployment insurance, even though I was eligible for it. But yeah, doing those two things, then working for months and not having to, or working for months without actually doing any work, but still getting the paycheck and then getting the severance brought in a lot of value.
And then I tried to ask earlier, but then we started talking about something else. Did you have any ethical dilemmas about not doing much work or because of the way you were treated and going above and beyond in the past in a net system? Yeah. It worked out even.
I was like, this is my way of rebalancing the scales for sure, as I alluded to earlier. Yeah. And I was also like, my work made this a transaction. They tried to get as much work out of me while paying me as little as possible. So I was like, all right, then I'll take the exact opposite approach. I'll try to work as little as possible and get as much money out of you. So,
okay. Yeah. That was my North Star as well.
Did you get severance when you were terminated?
I did. Yeah, I did. It nothing crazy. I guess it was sort of like the standard. It was 9 weeks. So it was like one week per year of employment. And I tried to negotiate and they were like, this is a standard, man. Like you're not going to be able, like we're laying you off anyway. I'm looking at the time, so I can't go on for too long here. So I'll only mention, basically, I did a similar thing, a lot less work the last couple years, probably. But then eventually we moved and I called and I was like, hey, I moved. So if you want to make this work, we can. The weird part is like other people on my team, my couple peers, they had moved, but they didn't tell the company. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't want to do any tax fraud stuff. Cause I mean, they moved across state lines and they were paying taxes in Georgia. And I was like, that gets a little fuzzy. Like if they get called out and they're like, yeah, you logged in through the VPN from another state for like the whole year. So anyway, I was like, I moved. And then they were like, it should be fine. And then they laid me off like 2 weeks later, which was perfect. I also did not collect unemployment, but I had self-employment taking off at that point, so I wouldn't have been able to.
Yep. My one tip as an attorney, and this is not specific for anyone in particular, but it's general knowledge, is the way you can negotiate a higher severance. Because what severance basically is from a legal standpoint is that you are essentially settling any potential legal claims that you have. There's part of it is goodwill, which like they're like, we're firing you. We don't want to leave you in the lurch. We'll give you 1 week, 1 week pay for every year of service. But then there's also, I'm sure in your severance paperwork, there was a clause that was like, you agreed not to sue the company for anything.
Right.
And that's actually the meat of what severance is and why employers do that. And so if you have any potential claims, You can use that as leverage to negotiate a higher rate. And that's actually valuable to the company too, because a potential employment case, even a small one, is hundreds of thousands of dollars of legal work. And so trying to get an extra $50,000 out of them, they're like, well, there's a 50, if they thought to themselves, well, there's a 50% chance that Doug will bring a lawsuit and we don't want to have to go through the headache of hiring an attorney and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Let's give him a few extra weeks. So, and then I think the big one, you know, I'm a straight white guy. I'm not in any protected class from like an employment standpoint, but the one that I had, in my back pocket was defamation. And that's if anyone's ever written anything factually inaccurate about you in any of your employee reviews, which I had several of those that were just straight up factually inaccurate. A negative review that's general, that's just like, you know, if they would have said Rusty is a bad worker, can't really do anything about that. But if they said Rusty handed in these three assignments late and I had the emails showing that they had given me this specific deadline and I had turned them in on time, then that would be a potentially false statement that resulted in a negative financial impact on me. So it would satisfy the claims of a defamation lawsuit. So those are some of my legally ways of viewing this, and things that people could consider when trying to negotiate severance.
So you have a couple of examples that you noted here.
Yeah. So this was, a pretty good friend, and he was in sales, and from everything I could tell was a very good salesperson, but got a new boss. And within a week of the new boss coming in, the new boss called him into his office and was basically like, I'm restructuring things. By the end of this meeting, you need to either hand in your resignation or I'm going to fire you. And I think definitely caught my friend off guard. He was expecting it to be more of like a meet and greet, super chill thing, and had really good sales numbers. So I think was totally blindsided by this. And so he handed in his resignation, and I'm sure his thought process was similar to a lot of people's thought process in that scenario, which is, oh, getting fired is going to be such a black mark on my reputation. I'm going to have such a hard time finding another job. But he was unemployed then for several months after that, and he couldn't collect his unemployment insurance, and he didn't get any severance then as a result of handing in his resignation. So kind of a unique situation that hopefully a lot of people don't find themselves in, but it's something to maybe think about even while you're in a good situation is, you know, if you were ever presented with that scenario where it's resign or I'm firing you, say, great, go ahead and fire me. And I'll go talk to HR about my potential legal claims and we'll negotiate a severance and I'm going to collect my unemployment insurance. So,
and I was just thinking, like, based on what you said before, like if you're just kind of quiet and you operate how you're supposed to, you may have a pretty strong, like, because the person may have said some shit they weren't supposed to, or maybe in passing. But yeah, if you just kind of play it cool. And then we have a friend who their spouse is a lawyer, and it sounds like when they run into some issues, they will draft a legal looking letter, and basically whoever gets it is like, oh fuck, this is a lawyer. Okay. And you can tell by whatever, the letterhead and the whatever single spacing, whatever kind of bullshit you guys do, not you, but
no. Yeah. I do that lawyer. Bullshit for sure. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
It's like,
you better treat me right.
Yeah. So they can see it and they're like, oh, we're going to be talking to a lawyer, not the person anymore, kind of thing. So interesting.
I do that. If I get seriously mistreated on something, I'll do that. I'll send it to the person I've been interacting with, and then I'll CC the general counsel, which is like the head attorney at the company, and then I'll sometimes CC like the CEO.
That's brilliant, dude.
And
crazy.
And then it's like, guess what? Whatever delay was going to happen on my tax document that you were going to get me, I suddenly have my tax document by the end of the week, you know? So, but I don't like to play that card too often, and it helps if you have the legal training so that you can actually, draft it the right way. And then they're like, oh yeah, we'll do whatever Rusty was asking for here.
I bet ChatGPT could probably get like 80%.
Oh yeah.
These days, right?
Definitely.
I don't know. Okay. What else do you have here?
Okay. So this was another friend. And so he was actually in a protected class because his wife was in the military, and there are certain protections in the law that prevent employers from discriminating against either their own military service or a spouse's military service. So his wife got restationed, and this guy was going to have to move. And so he went to his employer, and this was right at the tail end of quarantine. So he was doing his job remotely already, and he told his employer he was going to move and continue to do his job remotely. And they basically said that doesn't work for us. You're going to need to quit. And so he, again, quit instead of making them fire him. And that's one where I think it would have gone to HR. The HR would have been like, why is this guy quitting? Or why are you firing him? Yeah. So if he would have forced them to fire him, it would have gone to HR, and they're like, well, his wife, who's a military doctor, got restationed. And it's like, you, and then I think the HR person, if they're any good at their job, they're like, really? You think this is good PR? Like, we're going to fire this guy who's already a remote worker because he's moving to to a different town. We're going to do that because his wife is military doctor. Like, she's providing an amazing service to our country, and we're going to basically punish him for that. So yeah, that was another one who quit. I tried to get word to him before he did that. I was like, man, don't quit. Make them fire you. But I think he was kind of in that mindset of like, oh, I want to keep the goodwill and things like that. But I was like, this is, I mean, borderline illegal what they're doing to you. So definitely don't quit under those circumstances.
Totally. Okay. Yeah. And I mean, these are, when should someone quit? Can you think of an example? I mean, they hit their 4%. They made the line.
If you're not getting fired, if you're trying everything you can to get them to fire you, and they just aren't getting around to it, then go ahead and quit. But I think, I mean, my take is probably 90% of people would be much better getting fired than they would be than quitting. So
it makes a lot of when you think about the issues, and some people may think, hey, I would not claim unemployment, but I mean, that's insurance it's part of your benefits. Like when I had my business, I paid unemployment insurance. I have to pay the fucking tax on that, right?
Right.
So it's a thing, and you shouldn't feel bad for claiming it because it's part of your compensation, really.
Yeah.
When it comes down to it.
When I was on a previous episode, we had a listener question where the listener was basically like, oh, I'm going to get fired, but it's because I'm fi. And he was kind of wishy-washy about whether or not he should claim unemployment insurance. And so I gave a pretty lengthy explanation there. So I won't repeat it here, but basically legally, ethically, if you're entitled to unemployment insurance, I think you should definitely take it. So.
And do you have any tips about detaching and not feeling bad about quitting or getting fired or laid off or anything like that?
I would say, I think a lot of people are worried about the hit to their ego. And I actually found it to be very empowering to get fired, especially when I was like, I'm driving the bus this direction. I'm going to get fired because it's in my financial benefit. That actually felt really, really good. And so if you can switch that mindset around, I think that helps a lot. And then I think also sticking it to the employer feels good. And I think it's something that's important on a societal level. We used to have a really strong labor movement in this country, and things that we kind of take for granted now, like the weekend, are things that like people literally fought and died for. There's a really good documentary. I think it won best documentary at the Oscars one year, but it's like Harlan County, USA, about coal miners striking, and their working conditions are horrible. It was at the time the deadliest job in America. And as a result of some of the safety regulations that have been put in place, there's almost no fatalities from coal mining now. So people were literally fighting from that. In that too, one of the cronies for the employer literally straight up murders one of the striking coal miners. So I don't know. I feel like you're on the right side of history if you're sticking it to the employers. Employers have a pretty bad track record, especially past couple thousand years. If you look at slavery, I think history is pretty clear on which side was in the right on that one. And then employers have, I think, tried to find different ways to kind of implement different forms of slavery where they try to get as much work out of you as possible without paying you the fair amount. So if you want a little bit of extra motivation on why to stick it to the employer at the end, looking at the history of the labor movement, maybe watch Harlan County, USA, and you'll feel like, oh yeah, actually my employer doesn't treat me that well, and I feel okay taking my small shot at them on the way out. And then it feels very empowering. It feels very empowering to be like getting the better hand, you know, getting the upper hand in a transaction with your employer.
One other benefit is, especially to the doing less work and getting fired, I think it can help you detach from your identity as a highly motivated, I'm using air quotes, productive employee, which is one of the biggest issues that I hear about from people, where they're like, oh, now I'm just some asshole that doesn't work. They don't use those words, but I'm just some person that doesn't work, and I'm not the lawyer anymore. I'm not the doctor. I'm just a person who retired early. And I think if you're a doctor, you probably can't do what we were talking about. No medical people do what we were talking about. Mainly IT folks and lawyers. A lot of lawyers in the community, I'm finding out. There's a whole lot of...
Well, I think the lawyer has the perfect brew for early retirement, because you have high compensation and just like a miserable job. Yeah. So it's might as well retire early. Yeah.
It does help you detach from that identity and kind of separate yourself into whatever more free, open time, especially if you're like, I'm not going to go to the office all the time unless I need to go in and make some copies or take office supplies. Or I don't think you did that. You could buy your own Post-it notes.
Oh, but scanning in documents, I felt like was not embezzlement.
I don't think people need to feel too guilty if you are treating it as a transaction. Again, when you're getting your salary offer or whatever and all your compensation, I mean, they're offering you as low as they can. And when you get a raise, same fucking thing, like the smallest raise they could possibly give you. And if I could go back, it, not a big deal, but I would probably switch companies every 2 to 3 years. They tell you not to do that because then they have to reach, I mean, it's a big cost for a company, but in many industries, like, you want to get a good raise, you switch companies, you learn what you can, you build your network, and then get out of there. You might be able to go back to this if you really liked it. I know when I started working at Accenture, I went to orientation and there were a bunch of new grads. I was part of that group. And then there were people with about 10 years of experience, and they started at Accenture. They went somewhere else and they came back. My hunch is they were now at sort of an industry level, kind of a higher pay grade than what they would have been if they just stayed there.
Absolutely. I mean, they've done very rigorous academic studies on the benefits of switching, which is another way of saying that if you stay at one employer for too long, that employer will systematically underpay you so that you're not getting your market value. And if you switch jobs, you get it. I think you get typically get a 20% pay raise if you've been at an employer for 5 years and you switch. So it's kind of similar to like the insurance companies. If you've been with one insurance company for more than 5 years, your premiums are probably too high. And if you went and shopped around, you can get a lower one. But yeah, that's just another way that employers are systematically just like every year, if they can just knock off 1 or 2% from that raise that they're going to give you and you don't go to bat for that, it's like, oh, well, what's the big deal? Well, the cumulative effect of that after 5-10 years working for an employer can be 10-20%. And if you switch employers, you can go get that bump.
Yep.
And if you're doing it every couple years too, then you're constantly staying at your market rate. And you can, I mean, I've had friends who've done that and they end up basically double of where the people who they started with at the first company are at. So
it's crazy. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Before we move on to the setting up debt facilities, you were out of the office for a little while. I gave you some paternity leave. What's been going on with y'all?
I was a little underwhelmed with how much paternity leave they offer at Mile High Fi for their unpaid, I failed attorney intern. That's what someone in a YouTube comment called me. So yeah, I have a new little baby. She's doing super well. And it just feels amazing. I haven't shared it on here before, but our last baby died from complications with childbirth, as Doug knows. And so, getting a baby, you know, just getting to have our new baby and get to hold her and cuddle her has just felt amazing. It's been, it's been about as joyful of a past 7 weeks as I've ever had.
Amazing. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. And I was able to swing by a couple times. Yeah. I dropped off some food and I mean, you guys seem awesome. I'm not a big kid, baby person overall, but I was able to hold the new edition and I'm totally freaked out, but you guys were very good coaching me and I'm so happy for you guys. Yeah. We're so happy.
Yeah. You did great. You were more critical of yourself than we thought you needed to be. So you held her. She didn't start crying or anything too bad. So
everything seemed normal. Now that I'm mentioning, I'm starting to get sweaty now just thinking about the anxiety I felt holding her for a second, but it's amazing. Any fun stories? I know you haven't been sleeping much, as many people can imagine, but what have you been up to?
Not as much fun stories, but our baby just started smiling this past week, so that's like super fun. But mostly a lot of like sleep deprived stories. So I'm staying up with the baby till about like 1 a.m. She had a night where she slept for 4.5 hours, so that was big. Felt like there was some sort of like lengthening of the sleep periods happening, but most of her sleep periods have been like 90 minutes to 2 hours, so hard to sleep. But I take the first shift and then my wife takes the second shift, so I'm mostly not even really sleeping till 1 a.m. most days now. And then my son is up, our 5-year-old is up at like 7, so I can't even really sleep in. But I slept 7 hours last night. I was like, hopefully that makes up for the deficit that's been building.
And have you been napping some and just catching a little sleep while
you
can? I
try, like yesterday, I took a nap and my son woke me up like after like 5 minutes. But we'll have like some friends. We'll take our son for like a play date and then I'll just go right home, nap, and then like wake up when it's time to go pick up my son. So,
And then
hopefully I'm like sounding somewhat coherent. If this is even somewhat coherent, I feel like I deserve major props from people for this. So
you sound great. Yeah. And you did the outline notes, you prepared ahead of time. Yeah. All good. And one other thing slightly related. So not as much sleep. You're trying to catch it when you can. You knew it was coming, so your expectations are that you're not going to be sleeping as much. But you generally lay off caffeine. Mm. And for a stretch, I mean, you actually encouraged me to like lay off caffeine. Did it for a bit. I think I started sleeping better, but then I got back on the sauce. And I'm back drinking like more coffee. I'm trying to limit it in some ways, but it's easy for me to fall right back in. Mm-hmm. I think you told me you had a little caffeine at one point.
I did some experiments. The first 3 days in the hospital, our baby was in the NICU for 2 days. So the first 3 days were like pretty intense. And I wasn't sleeping like more than an hour at a time. So the first day I did a mega dose of creatine. Okay. You do creatine sometimes, right? Have you heard about these mega doses?
I have,
So I guess the general idea is that like the 3 to 5 grams a day is like what's optimal for your muscles, but there's also a lot of cognitive benefits for creatine. And so if you do like a 20 gram dose, I think it is, it's supposed to give you like a brain boost and like kind of combat the effect of not sleeping. And so the first day I did that and I was really sharp. I was like, oh, this is great. This is going to be a great hack. And then I had another crappy night of sleep and I tried to get the creatine to go again. And it turns out that after the second consecutive bad night of sleep, the creatine can't compensate for that. So I was starting to feel pretty exhausted that day. And then I tried one of the days I tried just drinking a cup of coffee because I was like, oh, I'm so tired. I'll drink the cup of coffee. But then I actually need to be able to like nap throughout the day and get sleep when I could. So having the caffeine actually kind of had undermined that. And I was like, oh, I'm just getting less rest. And I don't need just that one boost of productivity for a few hours that the caffeine provides. So I had a cup of coffee. It did feel, I mean, it was almost like taking a drug. That night we had the Baja Blast Pie and okay. Breckenridge too. There was more caffeine in that than I realized. And I was like a little bit like I was on cocaine that night. But it was actually kind of fun because I was like, oh, I'm getting the effect of being on cocaine without having as many negative side effects. But yeah, those were my two kind of like sleep deprivation experiments. The creatine, I actually was like, oh, if I just have a one-off bad night of sleep, I'd probably do that again. And then the coffee, I was like, oh, it's just helpful to, you know what coffee actually does, because it doesn't regenerate you the way sleep does. It gives you a burst of productivity right after you take it. So, and yeah, I'm not trying to like evangelize, get you to quit. I just, for me, I've just been trying to be more mindful about when I have things and what they do to me. So alcohol, caffeine, just trying to be really intentional. So, and it sounds like that's the journey you're on as well. So,
yeah. Yeah. And it, like one thing that you said that stuck with me about the caffeine is like, you used to take caffeine and you would do coffee. Is that right? You would do coffee. So for productivity, and you're like, I don't need to be productive like I was back then. And I was like, oh yeah, I don't need to be that productive. And it turns out I do enjoy the boost in focus that it gives me, even for, you know, recording a podcast or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I think we mentioned it at the time we had the conversation where it's just like workouts and lifting. Mm-hmm. I can lift much more. I know my heart rate's a little elevated doing that, but yeah, I just have a lot more energy to do that kind of stuff. So it's a give and a take, but yeah, I tend to, with both caffeine and alcohol, I'm flirting with the edge of what's acceptable.
Okay.
Like for both, where I'm like, oh, I went over the edge that day and that was too much, and it impacted, funny enough, both of them impact sleep, and I'm definitely using them as chemicals to like balance each other, which is a really dumb way to do it. But I do enjoy the caffeine every now and then. So,
well, and you're experimenting with not using it at all, and and tapering it off. I know you like vary how much you're taking at certain points. And I actually don't, I mean, especially if someone is really working out a lot. I mean, I used to be a really big power lifter, you know, playing college football and stuff. And I always took caffeine before a workout. I mean, I was like, I'm trying to get as strong as possible. So this is a great way to boost the effectiveness of a workout. And then as an attorney, it was just like, I was sleeping poorly. And then it's like, well, if I have a cup of coffee in the morning, I'll get a 2-hour little productivity boost, and then I'll take another one like at noon, and then I'll even do one if I'm dragging. I'll take, you know, have a cup of tea at 3, but then it's so much that's so much cumulative caffeine. It's like, well, I got through my work day, but now I'm just sleeping poorly. And anyways,
it's too much.
It sounds too much.
And side note, because we could go on these tangents. So yeah, you played football, and I knew that you played football, but we were talking on a hike one day and I was like, how big were you when you played football? Cause you're strong, you're in shape now, but yeah, how much bigger were you back then?
It's like, I think my max was like 265 pounds, but I was like only like 15% body fat. So like ab definition and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I was like bench pressing, I think the most ever bench press was like 430 pounds when I was like 20 years old. So I got injured pretty badly my junior year, and then I didn't play after that. But I did all the powerlifting from like 14 to 20. And if you just powerlift 4 days a week, 48 weeks a year for 7 years straight, you get pretty big. I think the max I squatted was like 485, but I would always try to go pretty deep on my squats, and then I could deadlift like 550. So
Lord, that's crazy. Yeah, man.
Big. I was for most lifts, I was one of the strongest on my football team. College football team. So I was pretty big.
And you said 265. You're pretty tall though, right? You're
6'4". It's like 6'4", 265. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, and then I stopped working out as much. Like I was just like lifting weights like once a week, and I lost like 40 pounds in like a year from it was like mostly muscle. So it's like a balloon deflating almost, but I was still like plenty strong for everyday life. Yeah. I mean, I was primarily a math major at that point, and I was plenty strong for being a math major. So. Plenty
strong for being. And then I probably asked you, I'm like, oh, you're a successful lawyer. You were like, could you buy a suit? Like, did you have to get a tailored suit kind of thing?
I would always tailor them. Yeah. And then there are certain brands, like I tried to get like an Armani suit. Like when I was first getting a suit, I went to go get an Armani suit. Cause I was like, oh, I need to look like super whatever fly. I'm at a big law firm, you know, I've got to play the part. And, it was kind of funny because it was just like you could see my penis so clearly. It was so tight that you could see the outline of my penis. And my wife was with me too. And she's like, you can't buy that suit. So I was like, oh, maybe if I get it tailored. And she's like, they can't tailor it enough in that area right there. So, yeah.
Man, that's pretty funny. That's good. I don't know how we're going to top that. So maybe we should talk about the dead facilities now.
Abrupt turn. Yeah.
Now, is there anything, any other fun stories of just being jacked and then like being a math major? I mean, you walk in and
you're just like,
it's like, you're in the wrong class, bro.
I was part of this team and we solved this math problem that hadn't been solved for like 40 years. So I went to all these conferences to present it. And at some of them, people would like, they were like really challenging me on the math. And there were certain points, like afterwards, they were like, that dweeby little, like, you know, math professor was like challenging you. They were like, did you just ever feel like going over there and punching them in the face? And I was like, no, I don't think that would really like really convince them that my math was accurate. So, man. Yeah. One of the biggest things I found too is it's really not as great. I mean, being super jacked isn't as great as like people. I think it's going to be as it seems that some people think that it's going to be like some people seem to make it their whole goal to get like as big and strong as possible. I live that. And you're spending a lot of the time in the gym. It gets pretty boring. Like the food that you're eating is like, you're very concerned about like how many grams of protein and stuff like that. It's actually a fairly dull way to live life. Staying that big. Being right now, I'm almost like gym phobic. Like if I'm even in a gym at all, I'm like, what am I doing here? It's just not, it's not that great. The nice thing about football is that it was super social because the football players are all working out. So I like that. And that's one of the reasons why I did it so much, I think, is because of that social aspect. And then I was doing it pretty heavily for like 3 years after that, but without the football players. And so it was a lot of time just by myself in the gym. And I finally was like, this is not like, I've got to look for other like hobbies and interests. I started playing a lot of basketball because I was like, oh, I like this because I'm around people and socializing and like get guys together to play basketball. So
yeah,
interesting. So, yeah. Being jacked won't solve all your problems though, even if you're a guy.
I was going to say, and most of the time it's just other guys talking to you about it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's wow. I think people think that women are going to find you like super attractive if you're like huge. And it was more like guys coming up to you, talking to you about like, what do you lift? Like, what do you bench? And like, I was super athletic too. So I was like, I could dunk. So I'd be like, I was like 265 and I'd like go down to the gym and I'd be like dunking. And then guys on the basketball team would be like, you'd be unstoppable. Like you're like basically like Shaquille O'Neal, like, you know, so.
Oh man.
But I never had a woman come up to me and be like, oh wow, you can dunk.
Really
you bench press 430 pounds. Like, you know, yeah. I mean, my wife found me attractive enough, but yeah. Which is, so, yeah, but it wasn't like women were just like falling all over me because I had 19-inch arms or whatever. So, yeah.
Yeah. You're funny, though.
That's
being
true.
Being funny is better.
Yeah. If I had to pick one.
Yeah.
Glad I...
It's Doug here from the future. Not very far in the future, but just enough, like editing Doug. This episode ended up being awesome. It ended up being longer than we expected. In fact, somewhere in the middle, after maybe like 45 minutes, we figured out that we wanted to keep recording, but maybe it was going to be too long for one single episode. So we've divided it up. Next week, the second part will come out and you'll be able to get a conclusion to this long, drawn out conversation. We had a blast and it flew by. But we just needed to make sure that we didn't have a 3.5-hour long episode. So we divided it up. Just wanted to let you know that and look forward to the next episode coming out next week. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High 5 podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. Just earlier today, we had a Buy Me a Coffee donation from, I think it was Lacey. So shout out to Lacey.
Hey, Lacey.
Who really appreciated the food episode.
Okay.
And I was like, Rusty's about to come over. I send a little thanks video to most of the folks. If you donate enough, I send you a little thanks video. We're going to talk about food for a few minutes for the sound check, which is exactly what we would do anyway if we were like going on a hike or something like that. So we'll talk about some recent food adventures. You have a couple that you want to talk about, Rusty.
Yeah. First of all, I'm glad Lacey appreciated that episode. That was the one I was most in my head about after we recorded because I came over fasted and we immediately started talking about food and you had made chili and it smelled so good.
That's
so,
right. Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I felt like I wasn't as sharp mentally when I listened back to that one. But I do love that topic. So yeah. Couple of recent food adventures. We've been making our own granola, which is something we used to do and hadn't done for a while. And it's just like a super good, easy, fast meal to put together. And we were trying to do it with less added sugar or maple syrup and honey and stuff like that. And when you do that, it doesn't stick together as well. So I was trying to think of healthier ways to make it stick together. And so we started adding egg whites, which I did come up with on my own, but then I looked online and other people have had this epiphany as well. And so adds a bunch of protein and makes it stick together. I mean, our whole sheet of granola comes out as one full sheet when you do this method. And then it kind of creates a little coating on the granola too that prevents it from getting soggy in the milk as fast. So we homemade fresh granola, especially like the day it's made, just tastes so different than the stuff you buy at the store. So that's been a really good one.
And the stuff at the store does have so much sugar. Like it looks like a health food. The packaging looks like a health food, but it's so sweet. I was going to say, you shared some with me, so thanks for that. And it does, it's almost like the same, in air quotes, like candy structure to the granola because it protein really holds it together.
Yep.
I was going to say, very little sweetener, which I'm okay with. Elizabeth has more of a sweet tooth, so she was like, I might need a little more sweetener in there, which put maple syrup in it.
Yep.
Ever use artificial sweeteners and fill in the gaps for any other sweetener?
We've used the monk fruit extract. Have you ever used that?
That's the one I'm working with now, which seems pretty good overall. It's good.
Some of the other artificial sweeteners, they give me diarrhea. So
okay.
It's Mile High 5, so I'll just go ahead and say it. Yeah. It's
Carl would talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, but the monk fruit I have found doesn't do that at all. And then it tastes a lot sweeter. And then obviously you can ramp it up. We make about 8 cups of granola and we use a third a cup of maple syrup. So really not a lot at all. But then, you know, my take on that is like, if you're putting it on yogurt, you can use sweetened yogurt, gives you just a few grams of added sugar without all the added sugar that the store-bought granolas have. Yeah. Or add berries or something else that adds some sweetness. So we do not too much in there. I would consider using the monk fruit though. I think that's been really helpful.
Only a third of a cup of maple syrup. That's like just enough, barely enough for one pancake.
Right. That's what I think. I think about that too. Because I'm like, this is less syrup than I would put on a stack of pancakes. And it's, you know, going into probably what ends up being at least 20 servings of the granola. So, yeah. And then, okay. So then the other experiment I wrote down here is that we've been doing this creamy pasta sauce with a cauliflower base. And I'm surprised how good it tastes. I mean, it tastes about, I would say 95% as good as a real Alfredo sauce. It's basically healthy Alfredo sauce because you put in a little bit of milk and then you put in some Parmesan and some pecorino cheese, and it has a ton of protein, very almost like no calories in it. And then you have all the good stuff from the cauliflower, all the phytonutrients or whatever. And so that's been like a game changer. And that's like, that's creamy Alfredo sauce. And then we modified a little bit, put in some cheddar cheese and some canned tomatoes and make it more of like a mac and cheese base then. And so you're able to basically get the same creamy richness texture that you would want in like a mac and cheese sauce or an Alfredo sauce, but with, I mean, it's like a fifth the calories or maybe even less than that. So
I have not done too much with cauliflower. Occasionally I've done, what is it? I think it's like a Tim Ferriss, or I learned of it from Tim Ferriss. I'm sure you didn't come up with it. It's like a curry kind of thing. I mean, you put coconut milk in there, so there's a lot more calories and stuff, but it does have the base of cauliflower.
Yep.
Interesting. So most of the fat and sort of creaminess comes from the cheese and just a little bit of milk.
The fat does, but then it's amazing how much you overcook the cauliflower, and then when you blend it up in the blender, it becomes super creamy. So a lot of the actual texture just comes from that, and then you just add a little bit of milk, a little bit of cheese, and that gives it the flavor of a cream sauce. So,
gotcha. I'll have to test that out. And then did you find a recipe and then adapt it and start substituting other cheeses, and you were like, oh, we could do mac, like this will work for mac and cheese?
We live in Boulder, obviously, we live in Boulder, as people know, but there's so many healthy places around. And so one of them had cauliflower based cream sauce for a pasta, and so I just gave it a whirl, not knowing anything. But there is a good one that I saw recently on YouTube from Joshua Weissman. I don't know if you've ever seen any of his stuff, but
yeah, he's good.
His recipes are super solid, and I think he lost like 60 pounds recently too. So after I made this, I saw his, and then I tried his, and his was tasted better. So I kind of use his as the base for when I do these now.
Got it. Okay. And I'll springboard into my stuff so we don't do a whole other food episode. Similar, I've been doing yogurt bakes. So I think I probably saw some videos and I was like, oh, I eat a ton of Greek yogurt. It's good to mix it up somehow or another. So I basically saw a handful of videos and then just eyeballed it. So I think like, it's weird, but like you and I and many other people, Lacey perhaps as well, like you're at a position where you're like, I kind of know the right ratio. So I'm like, probably 3 eggs, probably a cup and a half of, I mean, I eyeball it. I'm not even measuring anything. And then throw in some protein powder, maybe some vanilla extract. And then it's a great yogurt bake. Sometimes I push it too far. Like I put too much protein powder in one day, and it was more like a protein bar.
Yep.
And it was a little, the texture was a bit off.
Chalky, yeah.
I also know that I love cheesecake, which is just filled with all the worst stuff. And I have seen like a similar recipe, and they put some low-fat or no-fat cream cheese in a yogurt bake with all the same stuff that I just mentioned. It's just a custard, right? You put some eggs in there, and it's awesome. Like, it's probably, I didn't do a side-by-side. If there was a side-by-side, you could obviously tell a difference, but it's like 80% cheesecake. Like that's what a cheesecake should taste like. The texture was fine. Again, didn't measure anything. Didn't like put too much pressure on myself. Just like I threw in the toaster oven, about 30 minutes, kind of a lower temperature. turns out awesome. Turns out really good. You could throw berries on there. And again, it's just like a good way to mix up like how to get yogurt and some protein in, way healthier, and like takes place of the sort of sweet tooth where instead of eating like a quarter of a cheesecake, I could have like a piece of this thing.
Well, the cheesecake, it's, you feel like it's an indulgence, even if you do it once a week and if you just have a small piece. So I feel like the recipes, like the one you described, are so great because it's like you could make the whole thing, eat the whole thing, and actually be
totally,
yeah, you know, not that bad. And it's like you do sacrifice a little bit of that flavor, but I feel like it's maybe like 5 to 20% of the flavor is gone, and you're getting a way healthier food into your body. So
yeah. One more I'll mention is smoked salmon and brining your salmon before you cook it. So credit to Amy Wilson, local Longmont resident around here. And yeah, she was sharing some of her salmon and she was like, yeah, I brine it and I like put it in the fridge to form the pellicle on it so it absorbs the smoke a little better and the texture is better and all that stuff. And I had been lazy, as everyone knows, and I'm like, I'll smoke it quickly. But turns out the brining helps a lot. The like letting it dry out in the fridge helps a lot. And I don't know, you probably saw the little electric smoker out on the porch.
I was going to comment on that, yeah.
It's perfect to like dial in the exact temperature. I have like an external digital controller and there's sort of like, it's like a heat barrier in there. So it sort of diffuses the heat. So you get the smoke. So I can smoke it at whatever, 110 degrees for a few hours to like not overcook it. And then like ramp up the temperature. Although I shared a little with you guys.
So much smokiness. It was delicious. I didn't realize the brining. You probably mentioned it. That's such a good idea. That's how they do pastrami, you know, and pastrami is like the best thing you can get at sort of New York style deli. So great that it works with the salmon as well.
Yeah.
Did you just start doing this? Or I know you made me smoke salmon this summer too. I didn't know if that would have been brined as well.
It had been a while. So Amy, like I said, reminded me in the last couple or like in the last year or so. But in the past, like I've had that smoker maybe like 15, 18 years, something like that. So in the beginning, I was like brining salmon and was testing a bunch of stuff out. But over time, it's like, am I getting much of a benefit from like the brining? It turns out it depends on the fish, but yeah, generally. Yeah. Almost brining, like anything helps.
I wondered if doing it on the front porch too is just a magnet for your neighbors. They're like, oh, it smells really good over at Doug's house. Like, maybe I should be nicer to that guy who invite me over for a meal sometime. It smells really good.
It's funny, every now and then, like even sitting down here, somehow the smoke finds its way down here. And I'm like, smells really good down here. Smells like a smokehouse in Texas or whatever, like piping the smoke down here. So anyway, all right. So we'll have to keep notes for the next sound check of the stuff that we're experimenting with. Because I assume you go in and out of different things and you're like, okay, I'm taking a break from X and I'm going to start working on something else. So we'll keep notes.
We can keep people updated for sure.